the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Justine Toe.
And that's the trick of it, I think. We do what we need to do, and then we get to live. Because this is how we survive. We tell ourselves that we are the walking dead.
Some call him Apocalypse.
He was some kind of god. For thousands of years, he's been amassing mutants to take their powers. He always had four followers.
Like the four horsemen.
They took him.
Raven.
The world needs the X-Men.
When they slaughtered Congress, we didn't wake up. When they blamed terrorists and suspended the Constitution, we didn't wake up then either. Now I'm awake.
The end of the world, as we know it, looms large in pop culture. And according to these doomsday films and TV shows, it may involve zombies, or superheroes scrambling to save the world from some villain, or a fundamentalist totalitarian regime ruling America.
Yeah, these films, I'd say books too, tend to reflect whatever our greatest anxiety is at the time. I remember in the 80s, it tended to be nuclear winter. Before that, in the 70s, technology was going to take over. It's funny to me that both those things seem to have re-emerged.
Yeah, I hear that James Cameron is going to reboot his Terminator franchise as well, again returning to this idea that technology is going to take over. So these films and TV shows don't just show us how the world could end, they also reveal something about the world that we live in and our sense that even though we feel that things should be on the up because, you know, we've got modern health, science, people are getting kinder, etc., well, perhaps things are actually a lot worse than we think they should be. I'm thinking, you know, climate change or political turbulence in the US and Australia, let's be honest, Brexit, things like that.
The picture these stories paint is often pretty grim. And sometimes people react by saying, surely we, that is the human race, would never let it get this far. Like we'd still be decent human beings at the end, right? Personally, though, I'm not so convinced.
Well, we managed to find an expert on this topic. Yes, a person who has studied and published a book on pop culture about the end of the world. Alyssa Wilkinson is a staff writer and critic for Vox.com in the US and the author of How to Survive the Apocalypse, Zombies, Cylons, Faith and Politics at the End of the World. And we'll get to her thoughts on that in a moment. But we started our conversation with her job because, let's be honest, it's awesome. How did she end up as a film critic?
It was kind of by mistake. So I actually majored in computer science and information technology in college, and I moved to New York City to take a job on Wall Street doing that, and I started dating my husband, and he had gone to film school. So we started going to a lot of movies together, and we started sort of talking about them, I guess, and it was a world that I hadn't thought about very much. And over time, I just got interested in writing about it. I started sort of doing it on the side. And I did that for about 10 years. And then the longer I did it and the longer I stuck around, the more people would hire me to do it. And so that was a lot of it. And, you know, there are other pieces along the way. The more conversations you have with people who are really thoughtful about culture, the more you kind of learn how to talk about it and write about it and really think about it well.
That's so, I mean, I guess we always hear about how we just often fall into our lives, but that's a really interesting track, computer science to now you're around film festivals, you're kind of traveling the world, giving, you know, lectures about this kind of topic. It's kind of a crazy thing, right, to have your life go like this?
Yeah, although one thing you learn when you study technology is how to look at a problem and break it down to its parts and then think about the solution. And in some ways, that's a lot of what criticism is you're looking at a movie, you're looking at your reaction to it, and then you're thinking about why it works that way and how to explain it. And so I think some of the powers of analysis you learn actually are helpful in criticism.
And can you tell us more about what being a film critic actually involves? Because presumably it's more than just simply, is this worth watching or is it not worth watching?
Yeah, it's a lot of watching mediocre movies and then sometimes masterpieces or the opposite. And I think my job is to watch a movie as well as I can, which means bringing a lot of things to the table, my own experiences, things I know, frameworks that I have floating around in my head, and then be able to look at my reaction to it as a good watcher, hopefully, and then be able to articulate why that reaction happened, and then also to make space for the reader to kind of have their own experience with the work of art. So really, I'm interpreting the work of art, perhaps, rather than critiquing it, and trying to make it accessible. to an audience, to a reader who might not have that experience. Sometimes it's to just say, this is bad, or this is a masterpiece. But if I don't add the why, this is bad because, this is wonderful because, or this has needs work because, then I'm not doing my job at all as a critic.
Can you give us a snapshot as to a couple of your favorite films? You know, what films would you consider are unmissable because of what they mean to you and also what they might mean for wider society?
If I were to say, if it's okay, films from this year that I found that way, they're all very different. One that seemed very unmissable to me was the kind of comedy horror film Get Out.
Mom and Dad, my black boyfriend will be coming up this weekend. I just don't want you to be shocked that he's a black man.
I ain't never seen you like this before, bro.
Meeting families and taking road trips. Don't come back all bougie, man.
Come back, get your damn pants up to your damn stomach.
What I loved about it was that it used the tools of comedy and horror at the same time in order to actually make me feel like I was experiencing what the main character was. And it's a movie that's kind of skewering kind of white liberal racism that thinks that it's very kind of evolved
tolerant.
And tolerant.
Yeah.
And it skewers it in a way that I think is really revelatory for a lot of people. You just don't, you know, it helps you see the world through a different set of eyes through two genres that aren't maybe always the best for that. So that was one. There was a film called A Ghost Story.
We build our legacy piece by piece, and maybe the whole world will remember you, or maybe just a couple of people, but you do what you can to make sure you're still around after you're gone.
Well, I can hardly even say what it's about, but it's basically this giant cosmic romance in a very tiny little film. And the main character spends most of the movie under a sheet, like a bed sheet. He's a ghost. And the filmmaker, I got to talk to him about it, and he said, well, it's really about thinking about your legacy, how who you love shapes history and the future, all these things wrapped up in this film that almost feels like an experiment by some children for make-believe or something like that. And then also, I've just seen a whole bunch of films, but one of the ones that I'm really excited about that's coming out is The Shape of Water, which is Guillermo del Toro's next movie.
You may think that thing looks human, stands on two legs, right? But we're created in the Lord's image. You don't think that's what the Lord looks like, do you?
Del Toro is not even always my cup of tea, but this one is like a fantasy and a fairy tale. And it's also really about like people who feel like they're different and how they're alone, but also how loneliness can kind of be something that brings people together, which sounds really pedestrian for what it is. It's a very gorgeous looking film, and it has some great performances. I was really happy to have seen it. In my experience, most people in media who don't have a strong religious background are very intrigued by religion and interested. They, you know, if you're smart and you're kind of paying attention, you know that religion is a huge driving force behind many, many, many things that are happening all over the world. So people who come from religious commitments, I think, at least at home, have a very have almost an advantage because we have a way of interpreting the world that is tied to tradition and tied to moral language that has largely kind of evaporated out of the public sphere for a long time. So for me, whatever kind of prominence I have as a critic is partly tied to the fact that I am like the critic who writes about Christian stuff too.
You can help interpret the times.
Yeah, you know. I've discovered when I was writing for Christianity Today that, you know, I was writing to a Christian audience, but there was also a lot of people who wouldn't have considered themselves Christian at all who were reading because they were interested in what we were saying and in how we kind of would think about this. And I'm not the only person who's doing it, but I've worked really hard to kind of develop that voice. And that's part of what got me, I think, in at my job at Vox was that that's a context that I can bring to culture that maybe somebody else couldn't necessarily have.
So if you're helping to interpret, I guess, religious themes for maybe a largely secular public, if someone was entirely ignorant of the Christian faith and only could be exposed to what they're watching, mm-hmm. what would they conclude about it?
It's interesting to see where religious characters pop up on TV. In many cases, they're brought in as sort of these voices of wisdom or advice or even sacrifice, which I think surprises a lot of people. But I'm thinking of two major shows in the U.S. One is called The Americans, which is set during the Cold War. And it's about some Russian spies who are living as Americans in the midst of the sort of the what's going on in the 1980s. And the parents are quite committed to the to their home country of the Soviet Union and to the ideals of that country. But their daughter, their teenage daughter, becomes part of a church, and she's actually baptized during the show, and she is attracted to the ways that that church fights for justice and also believes in something higher. And the minister in that show becomes a very key figure because he stands in contrast to these other ideologies of extreme kind of American patriotism and extreme Soviet patriotism. So that minister represents a third way in that show, which is something that I really hope people would take away as a good representation of Christianity. Or I'm thinking of the show The Leftovers, which was on HBO and it just concluded. And in that show, there's a character who is a minister and right at the beginning of the show kind of has a crisis of faith. And then throughout the show is seen to have moments where he has more faith or more doubt. And he kind of is wrestling with his relationship to God in the midst of a big tragedy that that kind of prevails over the whole show. And throughout the show, he is the person who people come to for advice, but he's also a very real person who struggles. And he's not even the show's main character, but he is, to me, a very good representation of what it is both to be a minister, but also to be a Christian. So I would hope when people see that, they see that in that a contrast to what they might see in the media or even just in the people around them in the U.S. You know, Christians are kind of caricatured right now and not entirely wrongly as hypocritical, as not really standing for the things they've always said they stand for. And this has to do with the political situation and many other things. So I hope that the contrast in those kinds of characters on TV to the characters we might see on the evening news might actually give people a fuller picture of what Christians are.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity.
Alyssa Wilkinson is a film critic and the author of How to Survive the Apocalypse, Zombies, Cylons, Faith and Politics at the End of the World. And it does feel like there's no escape from the zombies, dystopian futures and apocalypses that will certainly bring about our end. So why are we obsessed with this narrative?
Well, one big reason is that stories of apocalypse and post-apocalypse are basically as old as the hills. We just have a very particular bent on it in the 20th and 21st century, which is that the apocalypse isn't something visited on us by God or the gods, but that we're going to bring it on ourselves through science or technology or all these different ways that we might bring the apocalypse on. And so when we see that turn towards dystopia, I think what we're seeing is the optimism of the Enlightenment, the idea that we could create a utopia on Earth. That has proven to be false. These systems that we came up with to bring about a utopia have failed. And we see that all throughout the 20th century. So dystopia is sort of the more woke version of utopia. It's where we look at it and say, oh, utopia was only utopia for whoever created the utopia. Dystopia, though, is a pessimistic version of the future. And it's where we're kind of working out our biggest anxieties as a culture. Like, for instance, does the human race deserve to continue? Or would it be better if we just went away, right? Or how, if all the niceties of civilization were stripped away from us, how would we treat one another? What kind of a society would we come up with? What's left at the end? And so if we think about Hunger Games, for instance, it's about an authoritarian regime that pits teenagers against each other to fight to the death. But really, it's about a culture soaked in entertainment that's too distracted to notice that it's been taken over by tyrants. And the conclusion of the book is that someone in power will always be seeking their own good, but all we really have is each other. And that's the conclusion. And that's, I think, a conclusion that a lot of people are coming up with. Is that human relationships is where the only lasting good can be found. And this is sad in some ways because it leaves out things like good institutions. But it's also good to see that people are coming to that conclusion because that's a place that we can really start from if we're wanting to build a more just society.
And from what you're saying, it sounds as though even though we are a lot of these take place in the future, they're really just meditations on what life is like mm-hmm. right now, right? So you mentioned the distrust of institutions. You're saying that we right now have lost faith in the capacity for institutions to actually be promoting human thriving, but they're yeah. actually, it's all about a power grab.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the view that certainly a lot of young people have of institutions. There's a reason that most young people are really, really worried about committing to any institution. And I don't think it's anything more than fear of just the corrupt institutions perpetuating themselves over and over. But yeah, I mean, dystopian stories and science fiction and those things in general have always really been about us today, never really about the future.
So what do you make then of like comic book superhero films?
Yeah, I mean, those are almost all of those have their roots in the 50s and 60s and sort of a post-war and even earlier. So the idea there was always, how can we fight injustice? And the conclusion's always kind of been like, we need a hero to save us. Maybe we can be that hero, but really that's where justice comes from. And our obsession with superheroes today probably is coming from pretty much the same place. They also just make a lot of money, unfortunately.
No, totally. So. Yeah, that's an economic imperative.
Yes,
as
exactly.
well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. but the bigger question there is like, are we capable of being superheroes ourselves? So, and this summer, both Wonder Woman and the new Spider-Man movie really kind of focused in on that idea of they're not about ordinary people. They are about people with superpowers, but they also are more fundamentally about people who are grappling with like, what is human nature, and how does human nature cause the problems of the world, and then what happens next?
There's, comic book superheroes tend to kind of operate in a really polarized black and white universe, mm-hmm. but there's also texts like Deadpool, which mm-hmm. sort of really mess with the program, right?
Yeah, I mean, here's the pest. This is like the dystopian superhero, right? and that was teased in the Dark Knight trilogy decades ago, but there's still a hero, even if he's a dark and flawed hero. Now we see more things that are just fully inverting the trope in order to maybe expose some of its limitations.
And what do you think also about The Handmaid's Tale? Like, I haven't watched it, I have to admit, but I'm familiar with the earlier film adaptation and the book.
I mean, it's interesting. The book was written in the 80s in a kind of reaction to the Reagan era. The bigger question that I think animates people when they keep returning to that story is, what would it take for us to, as a enlightened and progressive society, end up back in that kind of a place? And the answer The Handmaid's Tale gives is really kind of sobering, that if we take our eye off the ball, if we get too distracted by our own comfortable lives, little by little, those rights and freedoms that we enjoy could be chipped away by people who are going to use ideologies like this one that the regime in Gilead has in order to make excuses for enslaving or creating these kinds of restrictive societies around the vulnerable. But really, it's, you know, if we keep being distracted, we might miss the signs that that's even happening.
Your book really engages with Charles Taylor's work mm-hmm. and his discussions of what it means to live in a secular age where people can freely choose to believe in the transcendent or not actually believe in the transcendent. Because it seems that on the one hand, something like Game of Thrones feels like it does admit the possibility of a bigger picture, because there's the White Walkers and that's the real war going behind the battle for the Iron Throne. Yeah. Like, don't get distracted by the Iron Throne.
Right.
But on the other hand, there's something like maybe The Walking Dead or The Hunger Games where there's not really any transcendent order mm-hmm. To be worried about. So like, as our secular age and that option to believe and not believe,
yeah.
that's reflected, right, in our stories as well.
That is, yeah. And I mean, it's interesting to see it in Game of Thrones because it is in a... it's in a genre that is kind of tied to things like mystery and forces from the beyond and all of these things. And yet, for the most part, for most of that show, the story had been one that was very, like, quote-unquote secular. You know, here are these people. It's just purely power. That's what it's all about. And there's always been this feeling that something is coming, right? Not even the feeling, but, like, something from that's bigger than us. And... the zombies in The Walking Dead kind of operate in a similar way. There's all these kinds of ways of thinking about the world through old tropes that take a flattened universe and make something more cosmically rich out of it. And that's, I think, what we see in a lot of these stories, is this grappling with whether the world is enchanted or not, and where is it enchanted, and what does that mean for us?
Let's talk about that idea of enchantment and disenchantment in terms of our love for stories, because we all want justice to triumph, the good people to win. We want redemption. These seem like really religious kind of themes. So is there a return of the religious in this genre, or did it never go away and we're just now paying attention to it?
I don't think it ever really went away, but I think it took on a different shape in many ways. I've been thinking about Stranger Things, which is this Netflix TV show. It's interesting because it's drawing on all of these older sci-fi and fantasy stories, and yet it's kind of creating a new one for our age at the same time. But the concept of Stranger Things is that there is a world around us that is in a dimension we can't totally see it, but it can affect ours, and the wall can become thin between those things. And that re-enchants the world in a way that is kind of stunning and feels right when we're talking about a story about children. Because when we're children, that's what we believe. And then we grow up and we stop believing it. So we're sort of brought into the story and brought along with it to recognize ourselves in it. And then this sort of mysterious or this transcendent thing pops up, and it adds a new dimension to the story, but it also kind of, I think, generally shows us that that's something we're really longing for.
A lot of these stories are really good at diagnosing our contemporary anxieties, but they seem relatively silent or hesitant when it comes to offering solutions. But you and Robert Joustra, your co-author, are quite optimistic that, you know, the world's not going to go to hell in a handbasket, if I can put it that way. What are the grounds of that optimism?
Yeah, when we hit that point, we're really working out of our Christian commitments, for sure. You know, Christians believe that the ultimate end of history is in God's hands. That's the framework we're coming from. And so with that in mind, it gives us a lot of space to operate without fear of the future or of each other. And so in the book, we actually take as our model Daniel from the Old Testament, who was a character who was carried into exile by a foreign kingdom, and he was serving the king. But he actually chose to serve the king. He chose to work for the flourishing of the place in which he was living, even though that wasn't his native land, so to speak. And so he became chief of the magicians, and he worked to interpret the dreams of the king, and he actually invested in that culture. And so we talk about sort of that option. That's the one that we would like to propose, is that there are many, many places where we can serve those around us, maybe even in ways that might make us uncomfortable or might not be safe feeling for us, but they bring us to a place of loving the world in which we're placed.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Justine Toe.
I don't think anyone except Alyssa Wilkinson can land a conversation about death, dystopia, and the end of the world on such an uplifting note.
Yeah, if you want to read more from Alyssa, you can see her work on Vox.com, where she's a staff writer and critic, or you can get her book, How to Survive the Apocalypse, Zombies, Cylons, Faith, and Politics at the End of the World.
If you want to share this conversation or listen again, you can find it on our website, publicchristianity.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please hit subscribe and leave us a rating or review. It helps us, and it helps other people discover our show.
Next week.
I didn't choose my caste, right? I was born into the caste, and I was born into upper caste Catholic family, and raised as such by my parents and grandparents. So I went through some of the brainwashing that upper caste people do.
Were you aware of the situation of Dalits and other lower castes?
I knew there was this group of people that we could not mix with, and they were treated differently. But I was shielded from the kind of misery because I grew up in an urban area, so it was not in my face. And like most urbanized Indians who do not see the caste system in their face when they are told, and many of them confess, we just didn't know.